Here we are. Wow, that's a good beginning. All right.
That's a great beginning.
Yeah, here we go. Back. How's that?
You, I can edit, I'm the editor, so it's fine.
So before I hit play on the interview with the oldest working comedian in the world, Lynn Ruth Miller, please be advised that we chat about and use language which may not be appropriate for the Kinderlach. Think of the children. You have been warned. This is the second episode of Series 2 of the Bagel Podcast, guesting on Jewish Renaissance and hosted by me, Hayden Cohen. Let me paint the picture. This was recorded a few days after we'd both performed at Linwood Festival in December 2019. There was a stand-up night run by Rachel Krieger, interview with her coming soon, and we were both on the bill. Also, as it's Linwood, my parents were there. No stopping them. And I expressly said, whatever you do, do not sit at the front. A stand-up is relatively new to me and it'll mess up the juju for this juju. Of course, they sat at the front. Lynn went right before me with a crowd laughing their spleens off. And when I followed, I started out solidly and then it became what can only be described as a humbling experience. And that's the context. As I'm sure you can tell in my voice, I'm over it. I'm over it. I'm over it. Enjoy the interview.
So for this bagel bite, I'm joined by Lynn Ruth Miller.
Hello.
In her artisanal flat.
But nobody knows about this. This is a secret. That's the best kept secret.
Oh, no.
Nobody knows about this because I don't do anything with it.
Well, we'll talk about that in a minute, I think. But here in the midst of Stamford Hill.
Hasidic
Stamford Hill, right?
Hasidic heaven.
When you said, you know, that you lived in Stamford Hill, I was there thinking, okay, because like your material is not Hasidic. No. And I was thinking, okay, well, Stamford Hill's quite big. You are in the heart.
Yeah, I'm it.
What you do, it seems to be condensed into octogenarian comedian started at 70, 71,
right.
70.
By the time I actually was doing it, I was 71.
Bro. It's as if I almost knew that. We'd just seen each other at
Linwood. At Linwood. Did you go to the hour one? You didn't go to the hour one.
I was too busy.
That was the big one. That was a good one.
You know yourself, when you're getting prepared for your own performance, you need to be in your own head, right?
You should be in your own zone.
I have actually seen you a couple of times on the circuit.
Ah. Oh,
yeah.
Where?
At the Museum of Comedy. I've seen you somewhere else as well, but definitely Museum of Comedy. I think you were on a lineup with Scott Capura.
Yeah. And I've gone to his shows, and he's so fast that you're absorbing all the time, and you miss. And then I read this interview we had with John Fleming, and he said, I just do punchlines. And I'm thinking, that's the secret, which, by the way, is very old-fashioned. That's not how they're doing it
now. This is weird. This is like, for me, two worlds colliding, because I know John Fleming. I've known him for years.
Oh, he's wonderful.
It is great. And he's a big Edinburgh. He's known for writing a lot about Edinburgh Fringe stuff.
Malcolm Hardy.
Yeah.
The guy that loves to take his clothes off.
And there's that world that I've had as a performer. And then there's my Jewish Limud world, which are two very, very distinct. The Limud world's quite... It's quite uptight, right? It's quite, everyone's a bit precious.
Oh, my God. Not when I did my comedy. That's what I was worried about. I did my one-woman show is what I did because I had time. And I did, because I had a whole hour. So I did my one-woman show. And that is a very edgy. It's got a little bit of stuff about being Jewish because I'm Jewish. And so everything I do is Jewish. But this was not for an uptight audience. And the thing that I was so thrilled about and surprised was they got all the jokes. A lot of my setups, like Scott Capura, are jokes as well. And they got it. And right. And I never expect them to get it.
I don't know whether I find it comforting that you are still riddled with self-doubt.
I am.
Or whether I find it horrifying. There'll never be a point
at which...
There'll
never be a point. What is it my mother's word or is it Yiddish? I no longer have spielkies. Is that Yiddish or is it my mother's
word?
No, spielkies.
Yeah.
Before I go up to do 10 minutes, because I know that in the plethora of material that I've got, I'll be able to pull off 10 minutes. And I now have a little bit of performance savvy, but that's 16 years. I had never even dreamed I was going to be a performer. That is such a joke.
How did that happen?
You want to be here for a month? That's a very long day. I'm a journalist. And that was what the first show was about. I'm a journalist. I have a master's degree in journalism from Stanford. I also have a master's degree in education because that was the first dream. But anyway, I have a master's degree in journalism. And Stanford is a very big deal in the United States. And I thought, okay, I'm going to graduate from Stanford. I will be 32 when I graduate. And I will get a job with the New York Times. because I already know how to write. And when I looked at all the recommendations that the teachers give you recommendations and Stanford Employment Service goes out to get you a job and that, because you pay tuition, a lot of tuition. And one of the recommendations said, when I first read her writing, I thought she's not going to be able to write her way out of a paper bag. But because I was already writing. I've been writing since I was 10. Anyway, but Stanford University with its mighty influence and its mighty networking did not get me a job. And as a matter of fact, I was jobless for a very long time and ended up teaching, which I didn't want to do because I had said to myself, I don't want to teach other people's children because I had wanted children. I had been married twice and I'm very, very old fashioned, practically like the dinosaurs. And I don't have babies unless I'm married. I know that's unheard of in this world, but I do not. I also do not have sex unless I'm married. And I know that is, oh my God, even the gorillas don't believe that, but I do. And so after the second divorce, I decided, okay, I'm through. I can't go through this again. I'm going to have to support myself. So I graduated from Stanford. That's the school. I got all A's. I got a couple B's, but you know, I really did well. And I thought, I'm going to get that job. And I couldn't because at that time, when you're 30 years old and you're a woman, you're unemployable. That was 1984. And so I couldn't support myself and I was not going to go crawling back to daddy again since daddy didn't think that I should even bother with an education. I remember that. Why are you going to college? You're just going to get married anyway, which I did twice and it didn't work out too well. So I was pretty terrified and I tried to get, by that time I had 2 master's degrees. So I went around trying to get a teaching job again, which is the one thing I didn't want to do because what I was doing with teaching was total transference. I loved those children. I wanted children more than anything in the world. And I was not going to be able to have any because of the hangups that I've got. I ended up being a professor. I kept trying to get that job. And that one woman show was about how I kept believing that eventually I would get that job. I was 31 when I graduated, but I would be 32 in about a month. And I did freelance writing, but freelance writing at that time was not very lucrative. And I was, if it hadn't been that I'd been in an automobile accident and my father, who was a smart businessman, had sued the lady that hit me, I would have had no money. But I was living on that money because when I divorced the first husband, I said, I don't want anything from him because we don't have children and it was my fault and it was his fault. So I don't want any, I'm not going to make him pay for the rest of his life when it was as much my fault as his fault. And my mother, who was a Jewish princess who intended to stay there, was, what are you doing? You know, and I've never been sorry for that. I did the right thing. But I had nothing. And the second husband, bless his heart, he was gay. And if he would have come out when I married him, if he would have come out, he would have been hospitalized. But he literally paid for that education with the money from the lady that hit me. And then I still had money left. And that's what paid for me while I was trying to find a job. And then I lived. This is an interesting thing because we think we're so used to the luxuries of life, we don't realize that we can get along perfectly well without it. And I mean perfectly well. There is no time in my life when I didn't have good, healthy food to eat, an adequate roof over my head, a decent car to drive until I came here. And I thought, no, I'm not going to kill all the British people too. So I just said, no, there was no time when my standard of living wasn't, a person in India would have killed to have my standard of living. But I was totally below the poverty level. I really so far below, there was no way I ever paid taxes because I was living in poverty housing. And I got a part-time job working. This is what's happening now to children. And I understand it. And I don't think other people really do get it because it didn't happen when I was young. Working on a part-time salary by the hour, full-time hours. No benefits, no anything in this charity housing. But I loved it. It was 1232 crib. And I loved it. I grew up in a very sheltered, upper middle class Jewish family. I mean, you know, my big conflict was what color cashmere sweater to wear. It almost killed me. I almost had to take a tranquilizer over it. Should it be pink? Should it be fuchsia? It was too much for me. That was it. And I met people whose big thing was, do we eat soup or do we not eat? You know, those were their big decisions. And that was and the man across the way had emphysema. And there were people that had absolutely no aspirations for college. I thought everybody went to college. They had no aspirations for education at all. Most of them hadn't gone past the 6th grade. And they were the nicest people I'd ever met. And I absolutely loved them. And they watched over me. They were wonderful. And that was when I took up art, which is what you're talking about.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
Oh, bless your heart.
No, there are three.
What are you talking about? There's all kinds.
There's two types of art that...
There's one where you can recognize it, and there's another one that looks like I dug myself out of a trash can.
Pretty much, yeah.
Pretty much. That's it.
Well, no, but it was like some of the art is what you would consider as, and I'm doing air
he's
quotes.
He's being tactful otherwise I'll shoot him.
I'm doing air quotes as proper art, you know, in terms of you can tell there's been brushwork and
that's right.
And you thought about lighting and all this stuff. And then you've got other art that's a bit more avant-garde.
It's definitely avant-garde, yeah. But I love it. I love it. It's the extension of me. I mean, you didn't behind you. Do you know what those things are there that are supposed to be clouds in the sky?
Is that polystyrene?
They're the little peanuts that you put. Yeah. I couldn't stand throwing it out.
I said this before I was going to ask, but is there a hoarding mentality there?
No, I don't have a hoarding mentality. But when I look at something, I think, oh, God, that would look good pasted on a board. I mean, you haven't seen, but I love Christmas. Because look, I'm so excited. I found this. And then this.
I'm going to explain. So we've got a one solitary. Is that pink?
Yeah, it's a glove.
It's a pink leather glove.
That's pink.
And is that a?
He's not really a Santa Claus. I don't know what he is.
It looks a bit like a ZZ Top action figure.
He looks, yeah, you know, because you can't see. All you can see is the nose.
Right.
And the beard.
It's quite cute though.
I don't know. He's going to be adorable. Yeah, I really can't wait. And this. If you can put this on, you can see. I can't wait till I do this, and you have to tell them that when I prop everything up with this, it's this.
So it was a coaster that said, it's all shits and giggles until it giggles and shits.
So I'm scouring. You can see when I walk, when I'm in a collage mood, I'm walking on the streets, you know, looking, what can I get? Who's dropped something?
So how did you end up then?
We were getting there.
Carry on. I got distracted.
All right, so I was at 1232 Crew. I was loving it. And I was a professor. And I kept sending out resumes because then we didn't have the internet. And I kept not getting any responses. And I would do, I did freelance writing for the Toledo Blade. And again, on a piece-by-piece basis, you do that, you write.
Yeah.
Except that I was trying to support myself. And I did cover articles. We had a magazine section, like The Economist. You know, they have that Sunday. I wrote for that. And I would get $50, which is terrible. Because it took months of research.
Right.
I did one on unwed mothers, which is, of course, now we don't even call them that. But this was a really big thing in the 60s. And among other things, I also had a complete physical collapse. I was in the hospital. I was a guinea pig. I was in the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, which is an experimental center for terminally ill people. Believe it or not. I mean, it's so ridiculous. I'm not dead yet. But yet. So I was there because I had this complete physical breakdown and nobody could figure out why. And I believe it was that Stanford University didn't find me that job. I invested in everything. I was sure that I would get that job if I graduated from Stanford and if I did well. And I did well. I did really well. And I didn't. So I was still trying. And then when I was 48, I got an offer of a job in Oklahoma City. Oklahoma City is awful. Have you been to the States?
I have, but not to Oklahoma.
You haven't chosen Oklahoma? I'll tell you why, because there's nothing in Oklahoma. Oklahoma City has the stockyards in the center of the city. I actually stayed there. The joke is I left, but I didn't. I left a year and a half later because, of course, I was fired. I was writing for two magazines and two newspapers, and there's one guy, his name is Dennis Suter, that still keeps in touch with me. However, getting to this thing, I'm still trying to get that job, and I'm thinking, well, if I get a really good break, if I see a really hot story, and I mean, I'm living in these terrible places, Toledo, Ohio, nothing hot happens in Toledo except summer. I mean, it's just really nothing. And then Oklahoma City, I got a fifth wheel trailer and I traveled around the country trying to, the Southwest, because John Steinbeck wrote a book called Travels with Charlie, and he did it. And I'm thinking, well, he didn't go to Stanford. I did. I'm going to do this. And I'm going to get still into this New York Times thing. And of course, I didn't. And then I ended up in California. And I ended up actually selling sex, not even knowing I was selling sex. I had no idea. I thought I was fixing them up. What is that called? What is the matchmaker? What is she called? Definitely a yenta, but it's a... it's not a
Shatkin.
Yeah. That's what I thought I was doing. And I was so excited. And I was actually selling sex at $50 a trick. That's what I was doing. But I didn't know it. Those are not jokes. Those really happen.
What do you mean?
Because I'm thinking that I'm fixing them up. I did. Now they do this. But at this time, there was no internet dating. And I wanted to have this was an ad in a paper and a magazine. And I don't have to tell you the kind of magazine it was. But I didn't know. know. I'd never seen the magazine. And they had a number. When you called that number, you got me. And I'm sitting in this real estate and lawyer's office in the back
of
the...
And you had to pick up the phone. Hello?
No, no. I didn't have to do anything because they didn't tell me what I was doing. I was fixing them up. I thought I was going to make them marriages is what I was doing. I tried to have parties. And I kept saying to JoJo, who was a former madam, I don't know how the hell I didn't figure this thing out. You know, we should have parties and get them to know people. And she's not telling me because she figured she'd lose her telephone operator if she did. And so she says, and that's it. So I've got this file cabinet. And the women, what I don't understand is the women knew what they were doing. I had so many other funny adventures besides what was in there because I didn't know what I was selling. But the men knew. So you have to understand, this is sex. You're getting 50 bucks for a trick. But you've got to take them somewhere to do it. And this is the thing. I'm not sure my audience at Le Mood actually got this because I certainly didn't. I get a call from this guy and he says, and I remember him as having the most wonderful personality on the phone. He was very ebullient and I loved him. And he said, I'll take all women. I don't know. I'm thinking, oh boy, I can get the over 60s. I can give that to him. And you know, I'm thinking Orange Blossoms, Wedding Bells, Bimas, I'm thinking, you know, I'm going to do this. And I was like, how lovely of me, because I can't find out, but I will find you, husband. So he said to me, well, I live in a, he said, there's one problem. And I said, what's the problem? And if you realize, and I told you in the beginning, I'm the kind of person that only has sex if you're married. I'm only going to have a baby if I have a husband. I believe in that whole rigid, structural sex education, which I always say my sex education was no. So this is what I'm thinking that I'm dealing with here. And always, because I'm Jewish, we always dress properly. All right. He says, there's one problem. I said, what's the problem? What's the problem? He said, I live in a nudist colony. Now, right there, he lost me. I had never even seen myself naked, much less anybody else. And to live in a whole group of people like that would have absolutely horrified me. I would have had to go into the hospital. I could not. I don't think I even ever saw my husband naked. The lights were out. I mean, no way. So you live in a nudist colony. So I'm trying to be open. I'm educated. And I said, I'm absorbing this. I said, oh, you do? I said, so what? Because I'm thinking they're meeting for coffee. He says, well, if you come through the front gate, you have to take your clothes off. So I am now thinking I'm off on another tangent here. If I had a first date with somebody and I didn't know him, I wouldn't take my clothes off right away. I wouldn't take my clothes off at all, but I would. So I said, why do you have to take them there? And he's thinking, where does she want me to do it? Does she want me to do it in a phone booth? Because he's got, he's not going to her house. She's coming to his. So he says, I said, what? So he doesn't know what to say to me. Nobody ever says what they're doing. So he says, I said, why do you want to take her there? He says, well, I wanted to give her some coffee. So I thought, well, that's really nice. It's as if your grandma was talking to you.
So how old were you at this point?
I was 50.
Were you very innocent or were they very?
Extremely innocent. I didn't know what recreational sex was until a nun from Sacred Heart said to me, I don't believe in recreational sex. And I said, what's that? So I had no idea at all. So the rest of this story, and this is true, and people think it's a joke, but it isn't. He says, I want to give him coffee. I said, oh, that's really sweet. Why don't you take him to a bowling alley? Because I'm thinking, this is the other misunderstanding. I'm thinking that if you live in a nudist colony, that you never put clothes on. So I'm thinking this guy's walking around Main Street without any clothes on. So I'm thinking he's not going to go to a bowling alley because the visual, that visual, he's not going to do it. So he'll put some pants on and that'll make it easier for my thing that I'm making up. What is it? I'm doing this little liaison I'm doing. So I said, why don't you take her to a bowling alley? And he says to me, you want me to do it there? And I say to him, do what? because you have to have a total, and I had many conversations like this. And I have two of them in the comedy thing. But there were just so many that just simply went right past me. I had no idea. Remember, I didn't see any of these liaisons.
The Lynn Ruth Miller I see in front of me now is someone who is... Innocent isn't a word that springs to mind.
I'm verbally educated. I am cognizant of the world. I don't do all that. I mean, I do that joke about swallowing. I don't. I wouldn't. I like kosher food. I don't know. I like seasoning. I'm not going to do that.
Well,
he's blushing
anyway.
Again. He's blushing again.
I don't know how to respond to it.
It's true. I know I'm very educated, and I know, but this was my first introduction to that. The big joke was I was living right behind a whorehouse. Everybody lives in these beautiful neighborhoods. I never have any money, so I'm living in these terrible neighborhoods. So they're living in this neighborhood. And I was thinking, of course, what I didn't know is they could have gotten it cheaper for me if they would have come, they would have called me, because they were paying $100. I was charging 50. There was they couldn't have done it. But one of the things that's really sad is because, I don't know whether it's sad, I think in a way it's good. My father came up from nothing. He was a kosher butcher's son, and he started out by going around to all the Jewish shops in the ghetto and doing their taxes, because he could speak English. That's how he began. And he was a millionaire. And he came to see me in California, and I thought my house was beautiful. And he said, "It just breaks my heart to see that you're living like this." Oh, and then somebody came in and robbed it. They came in and they broke into the house, and they took nothing and came out. And I told someone that, and they said, "Yeah, I saw your house, and I'm amazed they didn't just paste a $5 bill on the mirror and say, stay well." It didn't have anything. Where were we? Oh, we were trying to get that job with the New York Times. So now, by this time, I'm in California, and I'm living in this place my father is ashamed of, and I'm ushering for the opera and the symphony. And then I was attacked, and that's in my show. Anybody that saw it, that was not a joke. What I was doing, that was not fabricated. I was a victim of attempted rape, and I was pretty torn apart because he beat me up. And at that point, because he had a victim, and we believe that the landlord hired this guy because I had been evicted. And at that point, I believe that this was my mother, but I might have been wrong. I'm thinking back on the way Daddy thought. My father believed that if your kid had a house, that then you could cope if you had that. I managed to save money because I never felt I could count on my family. And I managed to save money because I was afraid I'd have a relapse from being so sick. There was a reason. My reasoning does not hold water, but there was a reason. I thought I was deathly ill. They sent me home to die, and I didn't. So I always thought, it's going to come back someday, and I better be prepared. So despite the fact that I did not have a lot of money, and I did not have very much at all, I always had rent and I always had food. So I would do things like with this ridiculous education that I had, I would babysit. I would carry groceries. That's what I was doing. I was trying to earn money. All that money, instead of spending it, I would send it into a Merrill Lynch money market thing that earned compound interest daily. So I managed to save $40,000 and never spent. And I remember when I found out that I had that much, I thought, Jesus, I could have gone to a movie. And I did. I went to the Park Theater. At that time, there were lots of yuppies, and they had plenty of money, but they didn't have any savings. So I had savings and no money. I started looking around to see if I could get a house. I had 3 dogs and 3 cats, and I couldn't rent anything. Nobody would let me rent, and I was not going to kill the dogs and cats. I was not. I loved them. I really loved them. And I was really very resourceful. And I found somebody, and he was one of the nicest men. He was absolutely so nice. And he actually got his brother to co-invest with me. But because my salary, it was a pension was what I was getting. I was disability pension. It was so low, I had to get someone to co-sign for me. So Daddy was going to co-sign. When he found out what I was doing, up until that time, they didn't know. Because I was, thank God, they were in Ohio and I was in California. Best thing that ever happened to me. But when he found out, he came up with this. It was the most ridiculous thing. He said, "I've always wanted a house in California." He was 76 years old. My mother was dying of cancer. "Really, Daddy?" "Yeah," he said, "I do." So, so he co-signed for me, and we managed to get this beautiful house. I really loved that house because I stopped getting evicted and I stopped getting thrown out. And at that time, single women didn't own homes, not in America. And the mortgage was very, very low because I used the whole $40,000 to, I can't say.
What
10,
year was this?
1983.
Well, women owned homes in the 80s?
Not that many. Not
really?
Not single women all alone. Divorced women, they had homes. But not single women. And then on my street, there were about 5 women now in Brighton. But I'm still looking for that job. So I finally managed to get a column in the Pacifica Tribune.
Although I do feel that if you're living in California, a job at the New York Times might be a bit difficult.
No, I was still drawing for the New York Times. I knew I was going looking for the big story. The idea was that I put it in one of these little defunct things and I send it out to the New York Times. And say, "Oh, have we missed this? All right, yeah." And I'm still trying. So I had a column in the Pacifica Tribune, and I wrote for a magazine called Coast Views, And then I was publish the books. And when I would publish the books, I would go to do the books and to promote them, which I'm going to tell you about because I really did a good job of promoting. And after I finished doing my readings, I would then tell jokes, the kind of jokes, the canned jokes, like, you know, a grasshopper walked into a bar and the bartender said, "Do you know there's a drink named after you?" And he said, "Oh, is there a drink named Bob?" Those kind. And I can do that. I can do that for hours. You get me drunk enough. I'm just, on and on. So they kept inviting me back not to talk about the books. I never sold any books, but to do the jokes. I'm thinking, you know, I'm schlepping all these books out there. And I'm not selling anything. So I was surfing the net for more jokes because I'd run out of jokes. And I saw San Francisco Comedy College. I thought, I've got it. This is my big time. You can't teach someone to be funny. And I'm telling you, you can't. I'm going to write a story about how this bastard is ripping off all these young people. It's going to get in the New York Times. I'm going to get that job. I was 70 at that time. And I sent him, at that time, you didn't have phones. You didn't have any of that. I sent him, his name is Curtis Matthews, whom I love. Hello, Curtis. I really love him. And I called him, and you left a message on a machine. And when you got home, there was a little light that blinked. Did you have that too? Yeah, there.
We were never quite middle class enough to have an answer phone machine.
Oh, well, so, well, I was. And remember, I was below poverty level. I mean, really below, but I had an answer machine. Anyway, so I sent him a message, and I said, I would like to write a story. And to do that, I'll come to the first class. I wasn't intending to take the class. And he called me back within 10 minutes, and he said, and all he heard was my voice. He said, "I just love small Jewish women." You know, there was a God.
How do you react to that one?
I said, "You have arrived. There is a God. He's very often busy. He very often doesn't know. But this time he was looking." And I walked in there, and everybody is 18 or 19 years old. There may be 10 youngsters there. And me. And he said to me, and I made some smart remark, and he said, I can't teach you anything, but he did. He taught me a lot of things. He taught me mic technique. He taught me what it is to get on the stage. He taught me what stand-up comedy was. I didn't know what stand-up comedy was. I had seen Johnny Carson. I had seen, but I didn't know. Remember, I really led a very isolated life. I had no idea that that was a career. And I'm thinking to myself, oh boy, this is going to be a good story because these people aren't funny. And all of them, nobody's doing it anymore except me in that class. I'm the only one. But they weren't really very funny, but God, they were nice. And all of a sudden, I had a society. And I've thought about this a lot because I didn't really realize until now. Before I did that, it wasn't that I was antisocial, but I lived alone. I had, at that time, 4 dogs, and the cat population came and went. I mean, I had as many as 9, and I think I was down to 2 or 3.
But you were the top cat.
I'm definitely the top cat. Yeah. No, as a matter of fact, they were. I love them. When I started doing comedy, I mean, you've done it. You sit for 2 hours while someone else is telling jokes and you're talking to people. You start making friends. I started meeting people for lunch. No way did I meet anyone for lunch. In the first place, I was terrified of food. I had anorexia for 40 years. But when you find something you really love, the rest of those little, what is it Sam Levinson says? Complexes, schmonklexes. My mother got rid of 10 complexes with the back of her hand. The point is, if you're really involved in something in this, the issues with food, the issues with clothes, the issues, they all go away. All I wanted was to be able to do this, and it was a fight. Nobody wanted my comedy. Nobody wanted it.
Why?
Because I was 70 years old and I was a woman and I was Jewish and nobody wanted it. And then I met this woman whose name was...
You're going to understand why I'm phrasing it like this, but how bad were you when you started?
Excuse me?
Because everyone's bad when they start.
No, I wasn't.
Really?
I've had 2 bad nights.
Really?
2. 1 in Bellaricky.
Of course, that's 2 more bad nights than I've had, of course.
No, let me put it to you this way.
But how? How do you get the... because there's something about the rhythm of
stand-up. I'm a natural funny person because I was marginal all my life. And the way I fit in was to make people amuse people.
Right.
Because I was not on their wavelength.
But then you have that frame of reference, right? So the whole thing about comedy is that it's you're bringing people along
with
you.
But I'm seeing things and I'm on the outside looking in.
Right.
I'm on the outside looking in all the time. I'm not a genius, so I'm a hard worker. I want to talk about how good I was and how bad I was. I'll have maybe two or three that'll go flat. But even if they go flat, they still are amusing.
Right.
But that's 16 years. Over the years, you get a sense of timing and a sense of rhythm. Joan Rivers, if you listen to her, even if you didn't hear what she was saying, there was a rhythm to her voice and a rhythm to her voice so that you knew when the punchline happened. When you're beginning, you're saying, what do I say next? And you've memorized those jokes. By the time I've been doing it for 5 years, they're a part of me. I'm talking them. And the difference is with young comedians that when they try to do what I can do, which is just talk, they haven't memorized it. So they mess up the word count. They mess up the word order. They mess up their timing. This thing is just a conversation I've been having for 16 years.
Right.
That's why I've got it. One of the reasons why I don't bomb is because I'm talking about a universal fear. I don't talk about, I do one Donald Trump joke, and it has to do with his not grabbing my pussy because it's on the floor. It's that. There's nothing I talk about they won't get. I teach comedy. The joke is, it's setup, punch. And the shorter the setup, the better the punch. That's it. And Scott Capurro says, I don't even do setups. I just do punch, punch, punch. You've got to have that. But when I do a story, it's setup, little punch, setup, little punch, setup, little bit better punch, setup, little punch, little punch. And then at the end of 5 minutes, setup, oh my God.
How did you end up in London?
When my father died, that was when I found out how much money he had, left us some money. And this is such a horrible thing. People will never go to my shows. They will hate me so much. My father died. My father died like that. He was eating a hamburger. That's what happened. Yeah, my sister called me and said, Daddy's dead. I said, that's impossible. He wasn't sick. Yeah, he ate a hamburger. And he went, he had an embolism. And he went, boom, we got money. My sister's best friend was the lawyer that was the executor. And he called me up and he said, Lenny, you're going to get some money. He never told me how much. And I said, oh, really? Hung up the phone and called California, University of California Extension. And I signed up to go to Oxford. That's what I did. I did two classes, two sessions, 16 weeks. And when I was there, they told me about the Edinburgh Festival. Because remember, I ushered for opera and symphony. So I'm a...
How many shows have you done at Edinburgh?
Oh, I couldn't even tell you how many. I started when I was 2005, and I did it up until 2016. But that's how I got the job. So after I did Edinburgh for a while, when I started the comedy, I remember I didn't know what stand-up comedy was, and I knew Hartley Kemp at C Venues because I'd been reviewing.
Right.
When I went to the Edinburgh Festival, first I went as a punter, and then after 2 years, I realized, nah, I'm spending too much money. I'm too cheap. So I became a reviewer for 3 weeks. That's what happened. And I reviewed for 3 weeks. So I knew all the venue owners. But Hartley Kemp, I really loved C Venues when it was over. I don't know if you remember when it was over on Princess Street. And they did the most wonderful theater, just wonderful theater, wonderful stuff. And I knew him. So I'm at the comedy thing. Remember, I don't know any comedians that are funny. And I call him up and I think, why can't we go to the, you know, why should I just go there and watch shows? I can do a show, you know, because in the beginning you think you're so marvelous, you know, oh, somebody laughed. So I called up Hartley because I knew him. And I said, how would you like comedy from San Francisco? And he's thinking Robin Williams. I don't know who else, but Robin Williams. And he said, oh, yeah. And he gave me a really good deal. And I got a bunch of comedians to come up. We made it. We did a show called Weapons of Laugh Destruction. That was what we did. It was awful. But I... In order to pay for this show, I did a free show called Paint with Lynn because Hartley had been wanting, this is in 2005, wanting to add children's shows to his roster. It was very forward thinking because if you look now, there are lots of children's shows, but then there weren't any. And we did it for children. And the idea was they would have to have a parent with them because I didn't want to babysit. And you will not believe this. I got women that were breastfeeding these kids to paint.
That's amazing.
It was in a little room. We expected 5 people. There must have been 50. While I'm there, this older man comes in with a little kid. And this is the first year, Weapons of Laugh Destruction. And I've never put on a comedy show before. And this older man comes in with a little kid. And I said, oh, are you the grandpa? And he said, no, I'm the father. I said, oh, why are you here? He said, well, I do comedy. I said, oh, so do I. And he said, yeah. I said, what's your name? He said, my name is Billy Connolly. I said, oh, how do you do? I said, you know Billy. Every time I think of this, I want to crawl under something. You know, Billy, I said, I have a comedy show too. And if you want to, this really it is. If you want to do 5 minutes here.
He's the type of guy that might have said yes.
This, I want to tell you, this man was so polite. I don't want anyone, nobody can say a bad thing about Billy Connolly. He didn't bat an eyelash. He said to me, you know, that is so kind. And I'm in this two-bit miserable show.
Oh, I love that story.
Oh, because oh. I, and it was so good. It was, and he said, thank you. He said, I'll let you know if I can do that. I thought, you know, that name.
But that's Edinburgh, isn't it? You just bump into everyone.
Like, yeah, that's right.
I was walking along the the meadows when I was doing my Elders of Zion show, and I saw David Baddiel, and I said to him, I know I'm being the annoying performer talking to you, but this is about Jewish conspiracy theories. It's your bag. You probably can't come, but here's a flyer. Because that's the nature of Edinburgh, isn't it?
That's right. That's right.
I don't think he came, but you know.
But you do it.
You do it.
You do it. No, but this is, and I called the PR lady at the time, is a woman named Laura Davis. And I called her, you know, someone named. I started out, first woman's a comedy show. And then I did 3 years of storytelling. And then I found the Free Fringe. And I started doing cabaret. And I created a show called Aging is Amazing, which is still my classic funny cabaret. And that's where I throw the diapers at people and the condoms and the wigs. I throw a lot of things. There's a lot of things I throw. Then I found the Brighton Festival. So I found the Brighton Festival and I started doing that. And a guy named Bill Smith, who runs the latest TV, he saw Aging is Amazing and he said, why don't you take the best of what you're doing and put it together in one great show with a band? And I said, because I have no money. And he said, I'll pay for it. And that year, I was 79. I broke my foot and I couldn't go to the Edinburgh Festival. When I broke my foot in July, right before I was about to go there, this doctor came in and said, you know, woman your age, you've really shattered your heel. You'll never walk again. I've had people tell me things like this too many times. I don't believe that shit. Don't do that. So I literally said, get me another doctor. And I did. I got another doctor. And I stayed home from the Edinburgh Festival. He did the surgery. And Bill kept in touch. And Bill said, come early next year and we'll work on this show. And it was called Granny's Gone Wild. And it was a mixture of the songs that I do, 2 songs that he wrote. And it wasn't really that good in the beginning. But I worked on it with a guy named Richard Daniels and with my friend Sarah Louise. We got rid of the stuff that was really bad. And I get a call in the last week. It was like Frodo McDaniels. He said, you've been nominated for Best Cabaret of the... And I thought, no. And I won it. I've won crazy prizes. I also won Best Performer at the Austin International Burlesque Festival, which is ridiculous. I'm terrible at it, but I won it. And I went to a workshop there. And when I went to that workshop, this little girl, and you know, the burlesque girls spend a lot of money for their costumes. I don't, because I just end up in some kind of funny thing. But I mean, it's if it isn't a charity shop thing, it's, believe me, it's ridiculous. But I don't spend a lot of money. I never spend a lot of money. I never have it. She said, we've spent so much money designing our clothes, designing our costumes, being trained in dancing, being trained in burlesque. I had done nothing. I was singing a song I sang when I was 8 years old. That's all. And ripping off clothes. That's all I'm doing. And she said, if they can get you, and especially I am now a prize winner for nothing, why should they hire any of us? Mm-hmm. And when I did that, I thought, okay, never again. So for comedy, it took me a little bit longer. I decided, no, I can't. I'm a good comedian. What I am is consistent. If we really get talking, I can tell you all kinds of comics that are so much better than I am, so much sharper, so much more intelligent. Well, Scott Caparo is one. There's so many that
I think you're doing yourself down.
Oh, but I love that. Keep saying it. But I'm telling you, but I am consistent. You can count on, you get me up there, I'm going to get a hell of a lot of laughs. Any audience.
When I was doing Edinburgh shows, I never wanted to get 3-star reviews. I either wanted 4 5-stars or 1 and 2, because someone has an opinion. Someone cares enough to love it or hate it. Mm-hmm. For me, the idea of being competent is just...
You don't like competent, but I am what I am is reliable. When they
I'm reliable in my job, but when I'm on stage, you don't want to be reliable, do you?
I want to be wonderful. But the point is that what I've
and
got
I think from, you are wonderful.
Oh, bless you, that's so sweet. But what I know is they can count on my getting laughs. And we get back to this audience question.
So that means you're better than competent. But anyway, carry on.
With audiences, and believe me, every time I get up there, you told me that's Yiddish is spielkies. I have so many spielkies. I'm a mess. I can't eat before a performance.
Because, yeah, me neither.
Oh, no, I'll have diarrhea all over the place. And I've had it happen. It happened in Ireland. I'll never forget it. I was practically telling a joke. I'm running to the can and telling a joke. I cannot eat before because I'm too nervous. And I'm always worried this time it won't work. You need to know, and you shouldn't wrap it up until you know, that I have a very hard time getting gigs here in London.
Really?
Very hard. And it's just... there are too many of us.
Octogenarian little female Jewish stand-up.
Yeah, there are just so many of us. Just teeming with our little Zimmer frames and our little nappies. We're there, beating on the door with our little false teeth, slamming yes.
I feel like you've got a niche cornered.
I do. There's a woman that just decided to key in on my market, and she said, second oldest comedian. She's not even 70. And I thought, you know, poopsie, you're not there. No, I know that. But what I mean, there are too many comedians. I can't figure it out because I will do really well and then I won't get back. And in the Comedy Store, my friend Tiff Stevenson, do you know Tiff Stevenson?
Yeah.
Don't you love her?
She's great.
She's marvelous. When you came in, I was finishing an email to her. I love her. She said to him, why don't you put Lynn Ruth Miller up? She's a niche comedian. Yeah. He said, yeah, but all she talks about is being old. And she said, I'm sitting there with Ian Stone and Saul Bernstein, who was the other, what's his name? I know his name, but it's Saul Bernstein. Yeah. And she's, all they talk about is being old. And she's really old. And yeah.
But when you're in comedy, you talk about what your
That's right.
experience is, what your frame of reference is. And then you go, well, actually, you might think I'm weird for my, but this is why it's funny, right? That's what all comedians do.
That's what I'm telling you. So I have a bad time in London. And one of the things I want to get the PhD in is I've thought about this a lot. I'm applying for an Arts Council grant a moment because I want to get it. And I'm doing a thing called I've Got Plans. And in that one, I'm talking about the doors that have been shut to me. And they are shut. But the next thing I want to do is, and I want to do a PhD about it, and I'm really excited about it, and I've got to live long enough to finish it. Live long enough. I'm taking vitamins. I'm mainlining vitamins. Here I am, vitamin D. Yeah, I'm going to do it. Because what I want to do is, it's unintentional, but society has set up barriers, and I have barriers inside me that keep people from 65 over... to know the options, to realize what they can be. I have no special talent. I have developed a talent. You've seen it. It took me 16 years to develop this talent. I have no special talent. I've been writing since I was 10. I'm a good writer, but I started when I was 10. Nothing happens immediately. But if I would have had a relationship, if I would have children, none of this would have been possible for me. And that shouldn't be. That shouldn't be.
Right.
And that's what I want the PhD to be about. Because inside me, I see it with these women that say, oh, I really can't wear short dresses. I wear short dresses all the time. I love it.
I love the fact that you really, you're just doing what you're doing.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, that's this.
Right. That's all this. And I really hope I am half as talented as you are by I'm an octogenarian.
But you got to work at it.
I'm doing
what
I can.
But you're very funny. I told your parents, you're funny. You've got to, you have to have a sense of funny, and you have to have, it's more than a sense of funny. It's also, it isn't solipsistic. I mean, I'm solipsistic, but it's funny that someone can relate to.
Right.
So you get some of those youngsters that were up with us. They're talking about stuff that's funny to them, but I mean, we really don't give a shit. But anybody sitting there is scared to death of being 86. They're thinking, I'll either be dead, I'll be in an urn, or I'm going to be drooling and dribbling. Well, I am drooling and dribbling, and I'm having a marvelous time at it. And this is the point.
I can't think of a better message to finish on.
Lynn Ruth Miller, thank you very much. Rolling and dribbling, thank you very much.
And that was Lynn Ruth Miller. Her book, Getting the Last Laugh, is available everywhere you buy books. If you enjoyed the interview, please do share with all your friends. This was an episode of Season 2 of the Bagel Podcast, guesting on Jewish Renaissance, and I'm Hayden Cohen. See you soon, Bagelers!